Morning, Mel. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Oh, that's great. How are you, sir?
A bit tired, but otherwise okay.
Thank you so much. These early mornings take their toll sometimes. Thank you so much for being here. Sir Humphrey is blanching slightly at some revelations about civil service best practice or otherwise. The Lords Constitutional Committee have met and issued a report. We've been mumbling about the state of this government for quite some time, but is it now time for the chickens to come home to roost, so as it were?
You'd hope so. I mean, it's very suspicious that the former cabinet secretary just gets ill at the right moment and can't give evidence to the COVID inquiry. There's still, and there are concerns, I think, about the revolving door in Whitehall. It's not supposed to happen. You're supposed to have a significant period between leaving office, whether you're a civil servant or a minister, and taking up relevant employment. That seems to have gone by the books. I think it's Eric Pickles who's responsible for looking after that. He seems to be fairly relaxed at colleagues going off and the cynics would say exploiting the information they gained while in government for their private careers in the private sector.
Well, we were talking about lobbying the other week, which is, of course, has its defenders, but I suppose that's the traduced version of this very phenomenon, isn't it? I think when hopefully Graham will turn up in a bit, but it will perhaps be music to his ears, perhaps to yours, that there is such a thing as a constitutional committee. But there are also things like the Senior Leadership Committee, which we know very little about, stuff
But
behind closed doors.
the experience here and in the States at the Trump regime was that these things are based at their heart on the idea that they are, good faith players who have made a mistake and or might want to push the boundary a little bit, but not in a really corrupt way. And the rules are there to, maintain public faith in the offices by being transparent and making sure that the people recognise that their politicians are behaving honourably. If you've got charlatans in the main position, if you've got someone like Johnson or Trump, then it just doesn't work. I mean, I guess the single biggest laughable anomaly is that the Prime Minister is responsible for deciding whether a minister has broken the ministerial code. And if the Prime Minister himself is serially breaking the ministerial code, then he gets to mark his own, is a he in this case, but he gets to mark his own homework. And it's the result, I think. I mean, it's not the case that there was a golden age when the public really trusted their politicians. But I do think that public trust in politicians is probably pretty much at a low at the moment. And understandably so, because the string of allegations, it's usually the old adage that the conservatives are brought down by sex scandals and socialists are brought down by money scandals. But the string of sexual allegations and proven ones, and the Peter Bowen looks like it's proven in the sense that the Commons have suspended him. Following Chris Pincher, following
Crispin Blunt
the
now, haven't we?
Grenfell
Alleged
guy,
again,
and now we've
yeah.
got Crispin Blunt, under arrest, not charged with anything, not convicted of anything. We need to, or charged with anything. I think
Indeed.
so. We need to be very clear about that. But nonetheless, there is this, taking over just a sense of a self-entitled, group of people who don't behave in the way that broadly, we should expect our politicians to behave. Now, say, we shouldn't fall into the trap of thinking that politicians have always been lily white in the past and have suddenly become corrupt. A lot of writing going right back to the ancient Greeks about the behaviour of politicians shows that not to be the case. But then, so yeah, you almost wonder what's the point of all these reports being done? Because if they're landing on the laps of people who just don't get public service and don't get that it's not just about enriching themselves, then it's difficult to see where it actually goes. I think one of the great hopes for a change of national government is that Starmer and the Labour Party might be more serious about standards in public life. They could hardly be less serious than the current lot. But We'll have to see. You know, Labour themselves have not been immune from that sort of behaviour. Well, that's how it tends to be financial with them. So it tends to be things like the Paulson scandal with social housing in the 60s. Dennis Spall, who was the chairman of housing in the old Battersea council, and then with London Borough of Wandsworth when Wandsworth was formed in 65, was jailed for his social housing corruption. But there's
really?
But there is still a building, Spall Court, which is named after him. So his reputation sort of got away with it, even if he didn't.
What was the background of that, Mel? Can you remind us?
From what I recall, it was just a matter of siphoning public money into the hands. It was during the time of, it's before my time, but really, all this, to be honest. But a politician called T. Dan Smith in Newcastle,
yes.
And an architect called Paulson, working together to defraud the time when social housing was being built at an extraordinary rate right around the country, and Wandsworth, the old Wandsworth Council, and then the London Borough of Wandsworth in the 50s and 60s, you were getting thousands of social units coming online each year under the, particularly Harold Macmillan, when he was Prime Minister, pushing a housing boom, which created some of the, most of the great housing estates that we see today. There was this culture of corruption in a number of areas in housing. So in renting, there was a villain called Rackman who was exploiting people for rent. I mean, it was pretty dirty. And I say, really stressing the idea that public figures have not, in the past, were not always paragons of virtue. But they kind of, at least when they were caught, they were punished for it. These days, people seem to get caught, but nothing terribly much seems to happen to them. We've had the by-elections, to be fair. People have lost their political careers. But the levels are quite wide with these enormous parties going on in Downing Street. And people end up with 50 or 60 quid fines when, the general population, people are getting fines up in thousands, £10,000.
And the effective damage to a reputation is not that great. I mean, this is the week, where Johnson's been appointed to a thing called the International Democratic Union, chaired by the former Canadian PM, Stephen Harper. The blurb suggests that Johnson is still in post in all but name. That there doesn't seem to have been any sort of, as it were, acknowledgement of the fact that there are occasionally flaws in profiles in public life, or indeed much of a pause before election to a reflective mode of distant governance, you might say, or influence.
Exactly. I mean, you think of the likes of Harold Wilson and Jim Callaghan and Margaret Thatcher, and John Major. They never made enormous fortunes after their time in office. They well, certainly, continued to be involved in things, some of which they got paid for. But I think it was only probably really with Tony Blair that you started to get the idea of politicians making vast amounts of money when they left office. And it didn't apply to Gordon Brown. But then you did get to, almost to an oligarchy of prime ministers, and Johnson being the worst. It was about, when he was still in the Commons, was getting paid millions for his speaking career. It was never seen in the streets of Uxbridge and West Ruislip for a long time, as with Nadine Dorries. There was a quite interesting, you don't always see Rishi Sunak with a sense of humour, but there was a nice exchange in the Commons about the two new MPs who won their by-elections last week, and Starmer got up and talked about how great they were and how it was time for general election, and Sunak responded by saying, yes, I welcome the two new MPs. I suspect that the new MP for Central Bedfordshire will be rather kind towards me than his predecessor was, which was, I thought, was a rather nice line.
Yeah,
dig at Nadine Dorries.
Yeah, that irony sometimes betokens a certain humility, doesn't it? Yeah. you mentioned the phrase pushing the envelope, which is used by Gene, the disarmingly sort of described Gene Drake, very much title head of the Lords Constitution Committee, the chair of it, and pushing the envelope, and special advisors, particularly Cummings, who appears to have been, if not actually presiding, then very, very influential when a lot of these sudden departures of the civil service occurred. The special advisor that has no particular merit or rank within civil service protocol, I think, and that back in, when he came in, he started recruiting for sort of young internet mavericks, didn't he? I mean, there was an open call for people to work in his department. There seem to be spaces in the way the Constitution is arranged for these sorts of things to be allowed to happen. Is that a bit like oligarchy, or that, you know, at the other end of the scale, where people make good on their political fortunes in a sort of peremptory way?
Yes, I mean, there's always been this debate about whether you go to the US model of a politicized civil service. So when there's a change of president, your civil service all changes, and they bring in their key people. The UK model, anyway, whether it's been fully observed in practice, is that the civil service and at local government level, the council officers are politically independent, and their job is to offer genuinely neutral advice to their political masters, whoever's running the council of the country at the time. And of course, yeah, it's not black and white, and there is a context where civil servants would be expected to accept the policies of the government of the day and try to implement them to the best of their ability, whatever their private feelings about those policies might be. There has been quite a lot of talk over the last couple of years of civil servants, particularly I think over the Rwanda proposals, of being very reluctant to try to implement them because they either felt them to be immoral or impractical. And there's been always also when things are going bad in government, there is a temptation these days, which was rarely there, that politicians blame the civil service en masse. Always used to be the honourable thing was that you just didn't do that. The ministers would fall on their swords and protect officials. That's changed with not just civil service, but with the judiciary and all sorts. What elements there are of independent or quasi-independent voices within the political system are getting very heavily criticised on many areas. Same's happening with scientific advice to an extent, people who offer the wrong scientific advice because the science doesn't fit in with the politics tend to come a cropper fairly quickly these days. And it just goes back to this lack of standards. I thought it was very interesting that Sunak held a political rally during the Labour Party conference. And there's always been a gentleman's agreement, if that's not an outdated sexist term, that the political parties would not hold public political activities while somebody else's party conference was going on. And it just shows a kind of, a just slightly grubbiness, to a slight lack of honour, I think, when a political party just unilaterally turns its back on that agreement. And, one would suggest was actually trying to divert attention away from the Labour Party conference while that was going on. And it all just sort of adds up of the first question not being how can I be of greatest service to the country always. There are honourable exceptions in all parties, obviously, but far too often the first question being how can I enrich myself, and the second question being how can I enrich the prospects of my party.
Yeah, indeed. Leonie, good morning. How are you?
Good morning. I'm much better than I have been.
I'm delighted.
Really, thank you so- very, very ill last week.
I have to say it was wonderful to hear you, but not wonderful to hear you struggling vocally. But I'm glad you're back on point now. Thanks for being here. Well, Mel and I started talking about the Jean Drake report in the Lords about the state of, well, the revolving door, really, amongst other things, the sudden departure of those senior civil servants under COVID and since with Truss and Kwarteng. And she uses the phrase pushing the envelope rather discreetly. And I'm wondering how far this administration has been pushing the envelope and whether it will actually is in the act of bursting.
The act of bursting. Yes, I like it a lot. I mean, I was just listening to what Malcolm was saying. I do wish that before anyone was allowed to take up a position of authority in government at any level, that they were forced to watch all of Yes Minister and Yes Prime Minister, because I think that would give them an entirely different view of the how the civil service relationship, how the officer member relationship could and should work. I think there's been a lot of denigration of civil servants, particularly by some of the people who were very close to Boris Johnson, being very rude about their independence and treating them as sort of, a blockage. In fact, actually, didn't someone coin the expression the blob, as
It
if they
did.
were, just there to sort of block everything? And I just don't think that's true. I think blocking things that are very silly and impossible to do is, something that perhaps it's sensible for civil servants to do. The other thing that I think has been a massive problem is that the Conservative Party's had this whole thing about, well, if we cut back on civil servants, then that will save money, and we're spending too much money on civil servants. Well, that's gone really well with reducing the number of staff in the Home Office, hasn't it?
I was just thinking about that when Mal mentioned the Rwanda issue and civil servants being reluctant to implement it. Perhaps lack of staffing is part of that.
Well, I mean, how on earth can we have reduced expenditure so much that we have nobody left to do the assessment of people who are, seeking asylum or refuge with us, so that we're now spending this reputed £7 million a day? And that is partly because there's nobody left to do the assessments. Surely it's better to spend a bit of money on employing some staff who can get on with these things, rather than leaving people languishing in hotels for years and years and years. I mean, it's just insane to say that we're saving money on staffing costs and then spend it all on hotel bills. And I'm sure we're not saving £7 million a day by reducing down the staffing. And also, how annoying is it that we end up with these massive queues when people try to leave the country, when they want to get on? Why does it happen at Dover every Easter holiday and every summer holiday, the first few days? And that again is because there hasn't been enough people there to now, do the necessary checks because of Brexit, that we didn't used to have, because it was all sort of frictionless borders. Well, we don't have a frictionless border anymore. So, maybe we should just appoint a few more staff to help us, sort these things out. So I think there's been some very, very short-sighted and stupid decisions taken by this government for very, very silly and blinkered reasons that have made things work extremely badly.
One of the things that Mal referred to earlier on was the local chapter, as it were, the backwash effect of the Paulson D. Dan Smith problem back in the day under a previous, very previous Labour administration that was itself under a lot of pressure in various departments. And we were just speculating in general how a future Starmer administration might shore itself up, particularly with regard to the need for a housing programme, but also other infrastructure imperatives against the kind of rot setting in a few years down the line. I mean, generically, how is this best done now?
Well, I think the world is a very different place from the place it was when that kind of thing was happening.
Is it? Is it?
But
Hopefully,
yeah, I think so. I think the building controls that are in place now over letting of contracts and so on and so forth are much more pronounced.
Yeah, although it did, notwithstanding,
although it did result in a very very in, a very funny graffiti that I think it was Martin Linton who told me about it. Because he was a councillor back in the 1970s in Wandsworth, a long time before he became the MP in Battersea. But there's a building on the Winstanley Estate that's called Spall Court.
Yeah.
And Spall was one of the ones who was sent to prison. But obviously it's spelt like any other building that's called Court, C-O-U-R-T, Spall Court. And someone graffitied underneath the bit that said Spall Court, but the others got away.
Yeah.
Which is a nice play on words. I just think it's completely different in all local government. The letting of contracts, I can't see how that would make any difference to have a change in central government. The arrangements are all very much more constrained and looked into in a great deal of detail.
Mel, would you like to come back on that?
Well, just looking in ones that are beginning to look, there's been a few hiccups, but looking at governance arrangements and how to keep an overview on these things, because there are, you know, still sadly a stream of across the country of cases of corruption within local government. It's I don't remember the last time it's happened in Wandsworth, and indeed most authorities. And I don't think it's on the scale of what I suspect we're going to learn from the COVID inquiry in terms of the deliberate or casual misuse of public money running to many, many billions around failed approach to personal protection. But nonetheless, it's not entirely the case that local government has escaped from things. And we've got an issue going on in my ward at the moment, a house being built on a former surgery, where and it's not an uncommon story, Leonie will have similar ones from her ward, where the builders have really just behaved quite appallingly towards the local residents. But the system is that they employ their own building control inspectors now. Used to be the case that, quite sensibly, some would argue, that the council was automatically the building control managers. And so if there was a problem, the council was acting as the independent arbiter between residents and developers when it came to standards of work during construction. Now they can that's all been privatised, and someone can use the local council, but will very often appoint a private sector building control inspector. And it seems to me just an obvious and enormous conflict of interest that those building inspectors who say, right, you should hire us because we're going to be really, really hard on you and always going to make sure that you behave properly in all circumstances. Standing up against someone saying, well, we're going to be able to charge you a bit less because we're not going to give you a hard time unless we absolutely have to. And you kind of wonder who's more likely to get the business in those circumstances. So there are holes in things. And with the Grenfell inquiry still waiting, the report from the Grenfell inquiry, it's clear that something has gone horrendously wrong in recent years. You don't get Grenfell-type problems in those buildings we've been talking about, the ones in the 50s, 60s, 70s, the big housing estates that were being thrown up really extraordinarily quickly, particularly in London, but also in many other cities and areas around the country. And those buildings are very impressive in terms of the construction quality. Many of them, in my ward, if you have a look at things like the Wimbledon Park Estate or the Croydon East Estate, which was the very first London County Council mixed estate in 1952. And the buildings, of course, there are repairs needed all the time, but the buildings are in extraordinarily good shape compared to a lot of buildings of the early years of this millennium, which are already in a much worse state. And Grenfell Yeah, the block itself wasn't the problem. It was clearly the cladding, which was added very, very recently in the timescales of these things. And something just clearly has gone really quite wrong in the regulatory regime in which a lot of these things are done. It seems that it's almost a habit. I still think of all of the really shocking things that came out of the Grenfell inquiry, the one that has really stuck in my mind was a one of the contractors just quite honestly saying Kensington & Chelsea had come to them and asked a bit of a change. They could deliver this change for 300,000, so they charged Kensington & Chelsea 600,000 for it and just pocketed the other 300,000 on the quiet. And that, yeah, while that is the level of ethics and the level of people being able to get away with that level of ethics that is present in the building industry, I'm obviously not saying that all firms behave in that way, but Grenfell did. You know, the big conclusion, Grenfell inquiry, was that all sorts of people got things wrong, and that doesn't necessarily mean got them wrong by accident, that led to the Grenfell inquiry. Then I think something has gone really pretty horrendously wrong with enforcement and I think with ethical standards in some of these areas.
Graham, good morning. Welcome. We were
Morning.
just been chewing over the I think this might be music to your ears. Jean Drake of the Lords Constitutional Committee talking about the perhaps undue influence of special advisers and the departure and rehiring of more friendly civil servants, the politicisation of the civil service, and whether we're looking at chickens coming home to roost here. I also wanted to throw in the I think a somewhat ironic observation this week that the City of London is finding it difficult to recruit European bankers, and as and the premise is it's suggested for the abolition of bonuses, or sorry, the abolition of caps on bonuses that is going to create something of a second wave bonanza, perhaps for some of these departing politicians or indeed civil servants.
Yeah, Malcolm is right. From what I heard, it's taken the degradation and corruption of the whole industry has taken place over a very long period of time.
Would you trace it back to the 70s as we thought we did then? And the
yeah, and
possibility.
those new modular building techniques were the reason that they could be put up so quickly, and they were. To a very high standard, due to the research stations that were monitoring the developments, and so the all the new technologies were had to pass British standards, and got built to a very high standard, Parker Morris standard.
So
so.
we're not talking sort of Fordian built-in obsolescence here.
No, housing was built to last. It was so office building sort of introduced built-in obsolescence, I think. And then the construction industry just got more and more greedy. There's a very interesting program on the housing industry, and just put the directors of the companies refusing to disclose their how much money they're making and how poorly the buildings the houses they built performed. And so of course it's the buyers who get ripped off.
It's curious how housing is construction is so crucial to some political futures. So I was talking to a Turkish colleague the other day about the uneasy re-election of Erdogan and the fact that there are still curious relationships that his administration has between some of the people who put up the buildings that fell down and exactly how they fell down, admittedly under almighty strains. But that the construction didn't take account of the risk in the first place. So I wonder if there's also a wider metaphor here, quite a practical metaphor for how watertight an administration is, or indeed a system of governance is.
Yeah, I don't think we're quite as bad as Turkey. hope not.
I'm sure that's the case, but yeah, yeah.
But the Grenville Tower was about corruption in the building industry, you know, getting around the rules.
There's a very interesting documentary on BBC this week on what's gone wrong with housing, and an interesting juxtaposition on it of Eddie Lister and Ivan Dickerdon, the former leader of Wandsworth and the current housing cabinet member, who are pretty much as on the extremes of a particular view of social housing as you can get, to very articulate voices with very, very different views, and using Battersea Power Station as an example of...
And of course, Lister was with Johnson's cabinet secretary for quite some time, wasn't he, I think?
He was chief of staff.
Chief of staff, I beg your pardon, yeah.
Yeah, he was on the... I think he was deputy mayor for... Leon will tell me this, but he was certainly Johnson's chief of staff at City Hall, and then went with him with a bit of a gap into Downing Street. And Ivan, of course, getting... I think Wandsworth has been quite radical on social
housing.
But... there was a lot in there which I was sort of vaguely aware of, but it's extremely well put together, this documentary. Anybody interested in what's happened, not just to social housing, but to the whole housing market. Making the point that how when Osborne introduced this Help to Buy scheme, everyone at the time, or a lot of people at the time, were saying this is just, it'll help a few individuals onto the ladder, but without a significant increase in the supply of housing, all it will do is put more money chasing the same number of houses. So prices would go up even further, which is, of course, what happened. But then the great dilemma that if prices start to come down, those who have recently committed to it, to a serious mortgage, find themselves in negative equity and in dreadful straits. And we saw that in the early 90s when the housing bubble last collapsed, and many people were stuck in homes where they couldn't afford to live there and couldn't afford to move, because if they moved, it would crystallise the capital loss on the property. Very forensic taking apart of where we got to in housing. And the thing that always strikes me, Westhill Ward's a good example, but there are many everywhere, but Westhill Ward, up to the Second World War, was still characterised by some quite big Victorian villas, which had been established at the behest of John Augustus Beaumont, who bought the whole of Wimbledon Park from the Spencer family, from Lady Diana's ancestors, and had packaged it up into large plots of land with enormous gardens. And so post-war, there was a relatively very big, supply of land available, where the big houses had lost their role in life. Land was nothing like as expensive then as it is now. And councils like Wandsworth and London County Council were able to buy up these big estates at a really quite modest sum, demolish the villas and put in enormous housing estates. So the Edgecombe Hall estate, which covers Whitlock Drive in my ward, was a single family dwelling with quite a few children, quite a few servants, but enormous grounds. It's now home to something like 300 social housing units from the 60s. The problem now, of course, is that there are no such parcels of land just waiting to be exploited in London. Councils can, to an extent, infill on their own housing estates, and that's happening in Wandsworth with the Thousand Homes Project. Most of those are being built on land owned by the council. But of course, that in itself can be a bit controversial with people who already live there, who will lose parking space, will lose amenities potentially as the new prams are built. And it's a real dilemma that having sold off these properties, councils like Wandsworth are gradually buying back a few of them at prices massively greater than what they were sold for in the first place. But there just isn't areas like the last big one in the borough, I think, was the Orchard Estate in my ward, which was in the grounds of the Royal Hospital and Homes. It now is the big institution on West Hill, which had a large orchard, which you could sell off for I think it's about 250 social housing units. That was the last bit of land of that description that really emerged. Now, of course, there were some former industrial sites up by the river which became available, but that was the point where the financing, and Bassey Power Station is a good example, where the financial arguments started to get really quite difficult.
I suppose it's part of the tenet of a post-Thatcher view of political democracy and indeed the economy, that there has to be this umbilical link between a burgeoning, healthy, or at least growing economy and the state of the monopoly board in London. I mean, the provenance of this as a cultural metaphor goes back a long, long way. And with the removal of the cap on bankers' bonuses, is there a potential to look at a renewed kind of impulsivity that could also leach into the political system?
Well, I think it demonstrates the importance and centrality of policy. It's the consequences of policy that creates all the problems. If you get the wrong policy, people can get around it or not follow it. Or even if they do follow it, it ends up with the wrong result, unintended consequences and so on. So, I mean, that's the skill of governance.
Which seems to be sadly lacking in recent years, or as Malcolm put it, the sizable holes.
Yeah, well, it's enforcement mainly. I mean, it's been it's perfectly good law in place, but it's simply not enforced, and you get lawyers who are clever enough to get around it. And the corruption in the legal industry is, quite substantial, as was shown in the Brexit. I mean, it's lawyers for Brexit who got Brexit done by avoiding the Constitution and avoiding law.
I think lifting the cap on bankers' bonuses just shows how far removed from the everyday life of almost everybody else in the country Rishi Sunak is. I mean, it's quite unbelievable. In, the people who are coming into my surgery and probably into Malcolm's, people who email me at City Hall or as the ones with councillor, they are not, they're not in a good place. Almost everybody is really struggling with the cost of living increases, some of which resulted from the activities of his predecessor, Liz Truss, and her first chancellor. And, the sort of run on the pound and, the collapse of everything financial that has led to people having much higher mortgages. And Malcolm was just talking about Help to Buy. Some of those people took out fixed rate mortgages 5 years ago or 6 years ago and are now finding that their mortgages are going up because they're having to remortgage, 5 years on from when they first took it out, and discovering that mortgage rates are much higher than when they first took it out, at the same time as we all know, petrol and fuel have massively increased. So to find the government releasing the cap on bankers' bonuses, people who have probably paid a couple of £100,000 already for some ridiculous piece of reasoning of, it's just led base salaries to all be massively increased because the bonuses...
Indeed, that's what the Gloria editorial says, the lack of basic increase in salaries that led to this. But that's not,
No, it's the other way around, because they're having to increase... Because if they do it as a permanent increase in salary through people's base salaries, that's a bit awkward. So it's much better to not have the base salaries massively overinflated, but to just allow them to have bonuses that go up and down, because and then you can keep the base salaries lower.
The optics suggest the opposite, don't they?
But how does that benefit anybody other than the individuals who are receiving these very large sums of money? I mean, it's just ridiculous, and it's so far from, the lived experience of the rest of us. Talking about this very small group of people. So it's just the wrong time for lifting the cap on bankers' bonuses.
And it is a slightly funny one in that the public purse doesn't get anything out of this cap on bonuses. And yeah, if bankers' salaries go up and they actually pay taxes, then you could argue that there will be some benefit to the exchequer of allowing this. But I think, I mean, for me, the problem has always been not so much that people earned a large amount of money for doing a good job, but people earned a large amount of money for not doing a good job, and that these bonuses seem to come out of the ether, and everybody gets them at every point. You get companies that, yeah, you know, the banks around the subprime collapse in 2008, and a variety of other, you know, companies that you'll see, whether it's collapse of Wilkinson or other companies, where the directors were still getting all of their bonuses. The post office, I think, is the most shocking, which, having treated its sub-postmasters in the most dreadful, inhuman way, and only now just starting to make anything like fair recompense for that, when so many, you know, postmasters with many decades, in many cases, of good, solid service to their community, were caught out by a new computer system which completely, you know, mistakenly claimed that they were sifting money off the top. And the post office refused, you know, claimed in every case when they were dealing with an individual postmaster that they were the only ones and there wasn't a wide-scale problem. And there was hundreds of them, which the post office just hid as best it could. And of course, if the truth had been out from the start, it would have been obvious that it was, you hadn't suddenly got your whole system of, you know, often much loved people within their communities. You know, certainly in rural England, the postmaster or postmistress would be a trusted local figure. And you'd have realised that they hadn't suddenly en masse randomly gone rogue, that there was something else causing it. But even in those circumstances, people are still getting their bonuses. And that's what I think certainly stuck in my craw, and I think sticks in a lot of people's craw, the idea that the, you know, the remuneration committees of these large organisations are made up of people from other similar organisations, and their remuneration committees are, you know, potentially the people that they are judging on the salaries for themselves. So it becomes a real sort of, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours. That's how you end up with vast amounts of public money disappearing into PPE that doesn't work.
Well, I think also the water companies, I was quite shocked that Sarah Bentley, despite Thames Water being fined very large multi-million sums for sewage spillages into rivers and all sorts of crimes and literally crimes and misdemeanors. And she still pocketed a £3 million bonus or some such. I mean, it was huge, huge sums, which I thought was unbelievably disgraceful that she got this massive multi-million pound bonus in the face of some really terrible, terrible things that were going on. And then
was she chairman of Thames Water?
She was the chief executive of Thames Water. And then after all of this and lots of criticism, she promptly resigned without sort of saying why she'd gone or anything. But she resigned earlier on this year. So they've now got an interim co-chief executives who've come in. And as far as I know at the moment, they haven't been able to recruit somebody permanent yet to the position. So, and of course, in the case of the post office, a lot of the people that Malcolm is talking about got sent to jail because of this dodgy computer system that was throwing up all these fake figures. So, and the fact that they've not been paid compensation, some of them have now died. I mean, it's quite unbelievable that bonuses were still being paid in either of those circumstances. I don't understand why you're paid a bonus if things are really, really shoddy. Unbelievable, isn't it?
Yeah. And again, with Yes Minister as our source material, the one where there's an episode called Doing the Honours, where Jim's trying to get some savings out of the Treasury, and Bernard sort of inadvertently suggests that
maybe civil servants would only get their honours if they were able to deliver on. So Jim had to sign off on the latest round of honours for the civil service. Said, I won't do it unless you get the 5% cuts across the board. And then suddenly all the civil servants find exactly 5% out of something like that. But there's the scene where Jim is saying that the honours and trying to explain to Humphrey that they wouldn't get their honours unless they'd actually done something to deserve it. And Humphrey being completely
incomprehensible. Suggestion.
Yep. Just finding it impossible to understand the concept. You mean, do something to understand them, this? What do you mean? Mm. So it was very, well suspected that that sort of attitude still survives large in some of our institutions.
In the same episode when Hacker is asking the question about what do all the letters stand for, and they finally end up with some honour or another where the acronym is explained as being God Calls Me God, GCMG.
Yes, it starts off, you can get the CMG, which is Call Me God, the KCMG, which is Kindly Call Me God, and then the Knight Grand Cross of the Order of St. Michael and St. George is the full title of it. But yes, the GCMG, known as God Calls Me God.
So worth the unravelling. It might be a timely moment. There's a piece by Alan Rusbridge, who's now editor of Prospect, about the departure of Steve Bell from his both of their old papers, the Grawniad. And he ends with the observation that Tom Lehrer of Poisoning Pictures in the Park and all that's 995, who retired basically, having made an honourable pot of money. But when Henry Kissinger got the Nobel Peace Prize, and he said, this is beyond satire. So anyway, whatever you think of that, Steve Bell goes over a cartoon of Netanyahu and Charlie Hebdo and various other tropes sort of trotted out by Rusbridger, speculating as to whether we are looking at the demise of the political cartoon. And if we are, is that little corner of satire going to injure us by its absence?
There's a very good cartoon about the elephants in the room, and it wasn't an elephant, but half a dozen elephants in the room. on the consequences of doing nothing about the problem, including the water industry, which is continuing to grow as a scandal that is bound to burst at some point.
Well, one fears of a watering hole, I suppose. Yeah.
Yeah, but apparently people are refusing to pay their bills, the water bills.
Yeah, interesting times. Do you worry about the sorts of decisions that mean the life of Steve Bell suddenly disappears? No doubt he'll pop up somewhere else, but it's interesting that the editor of The Spectator, from a very different political corner, was defending his right to take, where necessary, heretical pot shots.
Clearly this is in the context of the dreadful goings-on in Israel and Gaza at the moment. And I think we will start to see a swathe of people losing their positions over tearing down the posters of kidnapped Israeli citizens and some of the anti-Semitic abuse that's going on, even in London. I'm not sure I say even in London, but in London, certainly many other major cities have now, a 1,300% increase in anti-Semitic attacks in London since the Hamas invasion. Pictures of Star of David being painted on Jewish people's homes in Berlin and the like. And having so far sort of cancel culture has been mainly the preserve of the left, and it's been people like Graham Linneman, the writer of Father Ted, whose careers have been destroyed because he holds different views on transsexualism and what is a woman than the left wing orthodoxy became. But now the same is being applied to people on the left, and I think that some of them thought, well, this is when we wanted to cancel people, we didn't mean us. We meant people that we wanted to impose our view on things. Now we're finding other people are kicking against some of the overt anti-Semitism that we've been fostering.
You would say voice for their own petard somewhat, yeah. I mean, the cartoon itself apparently references, this is a bit obscure, this, an image of Lyndon Johnson by a David Levine, so a Jewish gentleman back in 66. And it's this idea, it's referencing Shylock, isn't it? He's actually preparing to undergo surgery, self-inflicted surgery, suggesting that, you know, this is effectively, this is what the Israeli response is, an act of self-harm. And you might say also that Hamas is his too.
Yeah, and that's where it gets difficult, because as we know, there are a number of anti-Semitic tropes that have gone through. You know, Greta Thunberg appeared with an octopus in her background with a sign saying defend Palestine. And the octopus is a very famous Nazi era trope of the Jewish people. Yes, of the Jewish people as an octopus spreading their tentacles over the whole world. And that's not accidental. Yeah, you know, why else would you have an octopus of all things in the background when you're putting out something defending Hamas? She knew, she's not stupid. I suspect she knew exactly what she was doing in this case.
Well, maybe somebody did. I mean, she's young.
Maybe you can
presume
that.
Well, I don't know. We don't know what was going on in her head. Mm. But the outcome was that we had this very clear anti-Semitic trope in the background of the photograph, quite prominently in the background.
It's been applied to a lot of other things, hasn't it?
I think you're making a connection rightly, Malcolm. I say so with the general idea of optics and the visual saturation, and you know the dominant narratives that go with that, which cartoonists generally are trying to subvert, aren't they? Leonie, what's your take on
this? That's where the dilemma is. That when you start, and this is what I think the left are seeing, that once you establish the idea that you can destroy someone's career for having different views from yourself,
then there's no reason why that. Yeah, because you can instrumentalize this, can't you? Sorry, I mean, the Jewish people, although they're noble in many ways, are apt to get offended by things quite rapidly. I mean, this may be worthy, but also I think it's something that can be organized as a force majeure culturally.
Really not sure that's fair at all.
A bit of a gross generalization.
I'll take that. But I think it's the way in which very often the Israeli state becomes personally offended and compounds its own political actions with any suggestion of wider criticism of the culture or its right to exist. Not the same thing, surely.
It's now gone into the court, the International Criminal Court.
Yeah.
The Israeli state,
at the moment, Netanyahu is... I think he's horrendous, really, in many of his things. The attacks on the judiciary in Israel. Israel, generally speaking, is the... I don't sound like I'm particularly picking sides on this, but it's very difficult not to. And Israel is the one democracy in the area. I think of all the things that have really sent a bit of a shiver down with this... No, that's not true. But one of the things that I've noticed there is this sort of... growth of a kind of LGBT for Palestine movement, when Israel is the only state in the area where homosexuality and transsexualism is legal. Many of the more extreme regimes there have the death penalty for gay people, I think like it would be a mistake to judge the history of the UK based on the Johnson administration. So I think it's a mistake to judge Israel. And we should remember, Israel pulled out of Gaza in 2005. Israel pulled out of the Golan Heights and returned them to Egypt. It's not an imperialistic regime.
No, return Sinai to Egypt. Golan Heights is in the north of Israel, and I don't think that's Egyptian.
Oh, sorry, I'm upside down, am I?
Sorry. Yeah,
it's very early in the morning.
But the point I'm making is this, that, I'm almost tempted to say, compared with the Islam, which has been one of the most through the medieval period, was one of the most aggressive settlers and conquerors of lands near and far that we've seen probably since the Roman Empire. So this is a thing where we also must clearly and continually say that certainly the vast majority of Muslims I know in my ward would never dream of defending Hamas, or, and indeed regard Hamas as being
the biggest threat to the Palestinian people, a worse threat than Israel. So dividing along religious grounds is not helpful at all within this, I think. But Israel has always, I think its fundamental view has been to preserve its own borders and protect its own people. And there are questions. We're seeing, you know, last night, thousands of Hamas bombs still being sent into Israel from an area where the regime says it can't afford to provide food or water for its own civilians, but it can still afford these weapons that it's firing into Israel. And that's why ultimately I understand the sentiment about a ceasefire, but I don't really see how it would work. I don't see how the Israelis would not interpret a ceasefire as simply a chance for the Hamas regime to recharge its arsenal for another attack.
Well, I think that's why President Biden concentrated on the humanitarian provisions rather than ceasefire, because it's not practical from the Israeli point of view to have a ceasefire. And there's no idea that whether it would be agreed to by Hamas either. So I think it's a step forward that it's now gone into a court where you will get a kind of coherent and rational argument from both sides.
What is the court situation, Graham? That hasn't crossed my yard arms.
Well, the Palestinian representative has asked the International Criminal Court to hear the case of crimes against humanity.
Mm. They take a while, don't they? I mean, they assemble their evidence, and sometimes they don't act with the some considerable delay. I mean, maybe there's good reason for that.
Yeah. It's only symbolic because they have no power to implement. But the point is that you'll hear a rational argument. Of course, you'll go back, which President Biden also did in his speech to Netanyahu and the cabinet, to put everything back on the table. You know, he said, you know, we are democracies.
Yeah.
We don't behave like terrorists.
Well, indeed, although he's denying the link, the ground offensive has not yet happened. You know, it's I suppose the threat of it is very real. So lives have perhaps been saved. I think demonstrably been saved in recent days. Meanwhile, the aid is trundling in, really, isn't it?
No, but he was saying the limits of his support, America's support for Israel, is up until they start behaving like terrorists.
Yeah.
If they are judged to be behaving like terrorists, then... As Biden said, the terrorists win.
Meanwhile, Hamas have been meeting a version of Vladimir Putin. There's been another story in the Independent and the Mail about the several Vladimir Putins who are knocking around. One of them appears to have had a heart attack, another one the Big C. So we don't know which version we're getting, but there have been meetings taking place. Also, the Iranians present at these meetings. So it's a front being opened up there in terms of, you know, for that finance, diplomacy, what have you.
Well, I think global history is now being put on the table in the court. I mean, that's the interesting, because it would have to go back through
it'll
the
be
whole
factored in.
Right back to the pogroms and whatever.
Liam, do you think a version of Putin is eyeing up opportunities here with the chaos, or is it chaos?
No, I think this has been great news for Putin. It's certainly taken Ukraine versus Russia right off all of the front pages.
Hasn't it,
John? And of course, he must be laughing his head off at the antics going on in the American Congress, where they've had four nominees to find somebody to become the House Speaker.
Which old Trump's man has got the gig, clutching his Bible, or a version of
it. And now a guy who tried to overthrow the American Constitution has just become the House Speaker. He was a huge backer of the Trump attempt to say that Trump
God
had won.
God made me do it. Yeah, yeah.
When he clearly hadn't. So I'm not quite sure how that's going to help at all. But of course, it's meant that Biden has had his hands tied over trying to get a new package of spend to send assistance to both Israel and Ukraine. So I think that has probably been helpful as well for the Russians. or at least for Putin. I'm not quite sure you can necessarily say it's the whole of the Russian people. I mean, I think that is one of the problems, though, is the conflation of, which I just did, between the Russian people and Putin.
Obviously, no.
How much can you say that what's going on in Ukraine is something that all the Russian people supported? And the same in some ways in Israel, but for very different reasons. Russia is clearly not a democracy anymore, although they hold fake elections. But of course, anyone who's real opposition to Putin is languishes in jail. If they haven't fallen out of a hospital window, which is the other problem that they seem to have in Russia, that opposition leaders seem to, in fact, some of the people that Putin has just generally fallen out with.
That's extreme physiotherapy. Yeah.
Yes, fall out of windows. It's very, very strange. Must be a lot of disorientation in those buildings. But, you know, conflating Israel in the way that it's been over the years with the Netanyahu government is a bit like saying, you know, let's judge the UK by the Johnson government, or let's judge the US by the Trump administration. And one of the problems that they have in Israel is they have this extreme form of proportional representation, where as soon as you get over even the tiniest threshold, you immediately start to get one or two representatives in the Knesset. So they've got, you know, the bigger parties have had tails that have been wagging the dog. And so to form a government, Netanyahu, until recently, they've now got a government of national unity. And so I think some of the more extreme, really extreme people are not in it. But they have been pushing Likud further and further to the right. And so when people start talking about a two-state solution, it's hard to imagine where the two states are going to go, because there's been this thrust from these people to undertake these settlements all over the areas that could potentially form a Palestinian state. And for all the people who want to clear all of the Jews out of Israel from the river to the sea and clear them all out and return the Palestinian lands to the Palestinians, are forgetting that, you know, there have always been Jews living in that area.
Quite amicably, I think.
You know, always mixed in with the Muslim, Arab, Christian populations. And so to suggest that, you know, they should all be cleared out. And of course, you know, from the time of the Balfour Declaration, so, you know, we're talking now over 100 years, we've had people settling there. So there are now 10 million Israelis, or just under. Where would they all go if, you know, the Hamas dream was realised of completely getting rid of Israel? And I think people
it's the equivalent
need
problem to
remember,
Gaza, isn't it? The evisceration of Gaza, exactly.
People need to remember that a lot of this is being fermented by the Iranians. You know, people don't like the fact that the US gives strong support to Israel. But, you know, it's the Iranians who've been arming Hamas, and Hamas have just recently popped up. And we've just seen them in sitting alongside the Iranians. And when we've just heard these two big speeches in the United Nations, one from the Israeli ambassador and one from the Palestinian ambassador, we also then heard from the Iranians saying, you know, don't think you're going to get off scot-free here, America, if you don't behave yourself. I mean, it was quite a chilling speech from the Iranian ambassador, I thought. So in some ways, you know, Israel is falling into an Iranian trap. You know, they've created this situation to try and get all the neighbours of Israel, many of whom have started to regularise their relationships with Israel and allow Israel to exist with some, you know, treaty signed with its neighbours. And that's what the Iranians want to destabilise. And that's why this all happened when it did, because the Saudis were talking about signing a deal with Israel. And then suddenly Hamas goes over the border into Israel and commits a long string of unbelievable atrocities. So that's why I think Israel has interpreted what Hamas did as an existential threat, because it is.
So I wonder what future for Netanyahu has, when all this begins to, I would say, die down a little bit. It's not happening anytime soon. But there must be thinking within Israel about what we do for an encore here in order to preserve what they have. And in the midst of the constitutional crisis that was starting to happen just before the war was declared.
Well, I think they're going to have to get rid of Netanyahu. I mean, I just can't see that this can carry on. They had half of Israel was up in arms demonstrating against him. The only reason he's still surviving at the moment is because this government of national unity has been formed. But he doesn't seem to be much of a war leader either. I don't think they'll want to keep him.
I wonder if there's going to be a vacant, since Johnson's got a gig, not making a direct comparison, whether there'll be a vacant board seat of the International Democratic Union.
Sorry?
Johnson's just got this gig with the former Canadian Prime Minister as a democracy advisor.
Oh, I don't think I know about that.
Okay, I'll just leave that hanging. Thank you all very much. See you next time.
See you.